Evie. The commission meeting today is also being live streamed by Blue Room Stream. We do have some members who are not able to join us in person. There are some that are, and we'll get that to that roll call in a second. But those who are following us on live stream include Representatives Harper and Hernandez. So, Laura, do you want to call roll then?
Senator Aquino?
Here.
Senator Bailey? Representative Jigginsmeyer?
Here.
Senator DeWitt? Representative Ellis?
Here.
Representative Grant? Representative Harper? Representative Hernandez? Senator Taylor?
Yes.
Representative Mullen? Senator Sims?
I don't know how you feel about the state.
I'm going to go ahead and welcome everybody today. Senator Kaler is our new co-chair. I was one of the co-chairs during the 101st General Assembly, and I served on COGFA in the 100th General Assembly as well. I got to say it's kind of nice to be back, and I see we've got one of our new members walking in here. If you could add Senator Bailey to the roll. I think we want to introduce our new members that will be joining the commission, and we'll start with obviously Senator Kaler, my co-chair here. I look forward to working together. This is an interesting group. We get the opportunity to be more nonpartisan than even bipartisan, so it's great to work together. We also have Senator Aquino. Thank you. Good to see you. Senator Bailey. Representative Ellick is here, and Representative Grant, who I'm sure is watching from afar right now. So I think that we're going to go ahead and move on to opening comments from our executive director, Clayton.
Thank you, Co-Chair Davidsmeyer, and I just wanted to take a brief moment to welcome back our returning members to the commission, and also extend a welcome to the newly appointed members of the commission. As part of that, I also wanted to welcome Senator Kaler as our new co-chair of the commission. I'm joined at the table this morning by the commission's revenue manager, Jim Machinsky, and Jim will go through our PowerPoint. We have a copy of that at each of your places up there. That PowerPoint will show our updated economic slides and then our updated revenue forecast, both for this current fiscal year and then our initial revenue estimate for the next fiscal year. One scheduling note I would just mention is, as you may see on the agenda, our next scheduled meeting will be on the topic of group insurance and in the administration of the group insurance program. We haven't finalized a date for that, but we would be looking at probably either the second or third week, the week of April 20th or April 12th, for that meeting, for our second meeting of the year. As you all know, a lot of events have transpired since our last revenue meeting. The COVID pandemic was just in its very initial stages when we met last March. As Jim will note in his PowerPoint, we have done some previous revisions to our revenue forecast that we gave last March, to try to keep members up to date on the evolving picture, both in terms of the impact of the pandemic and then also the recovery thereafter. Due to this rapidly changing landscape, we have added some additional slides to our PowerPoint to try to capture the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. And due to some of our time restraints today, I think the best way we can proceed is just to go right to the PowerPoint, and then that will leave questions time for your questions after Jim gets done going through that.
Thank you, Director. As Clayton mentioned, we'll be going through the PowerPoint today. It's a rather lengthy presentation. I will try to speed through it, maybe not hit on all the slides, so I'll reference what page I'm looking at or can direct your attention to. We'll start first, before we get into the revenue projections, to give you some economic measures, observations, and outlooks we think are newsworthy. We'll start on page 5. which shows the United States GDP. The GDP, obviously, is one of the broadest measures that's used to help measure gauge the economy. It's comprised historically of household consumption, about 70%, business, about 17%, business investment, and government spending, an additional 17%. Next, exports actually comprise usually about a negative 4% in terms of its components. Taking a look at the graph, you'll see that after the recovery from the Great Recession back in 2009, we've had 10 years of expansion, the longest on record. It was quite muted, however, and not very... the growth rates were principally between the 0 and 3% to 2% range on a quarterly basis, but the consistency certainly was shown. And then, of course, last spring hit. We saw the first impact of the pandemic starting late March, and as a result, the first quarter of 2020 fell about 5%. But then after the much enhanced mitigations and economic shutdowns we saw in the second quarter, a record fall off of over 31%. Now after the second quarter, a new lower base was established. So you'll see almost an immediate increase there in the third quarter. Mitigations eased somewhat, and there was a little bit of a return to normalcy. At least people went out and were doing some of the spending. There was a pent-up demand. And so you'll see that the third quarter increased over 33.4%. Now, you can't take those two and average them and say, oh, no change, because remember, the 33.4% is off a much lower base. And then the fourth quarter of 2020, once again, regained a little bit of traction in terms of growth, rising about 4.1%. As of right now, the aggregation of economic forecasts of those entities we utilize would have real growth for GDP about 4.7% for 21 and 3.6 for 22. So that translates into a nice pickup going into 21, but then things subside a little bit, moderate into 22. And we'll get into more of those forecasts in a little bit. The manufacturer's purchasing index is on page 6. Of course, everybody likes to look at how the manufacturing sector is doing. And this slide is going to be indicative of what we're going to see throughout the economic presentation. That is a dramatic fall off in the first and second quarter, followed by a rapid recovery. Depending on the sector we're talking about, it may look like a V, it may look like a U, it may look like a Nike swoosh. It all depends on what specific sector we're looking at. But manufacturing, after suffering through that second quarter, started to rebound, and in August had an index value of 60.8, which reflected the same value, the same peak, back in August of 18. So we recovered very quickly. What's interesting to note on the manufacturing is, even prior to COVID, there were many who believed that we were in a recession for the manufacturing sector. You can kind of see that downward trend prior to COVID. But we have since recovered in terms of manufacturing. The following page is the services purchasing managers index. I still call it as the non-manufacturing index. It's much larger, represents about 80% of the GDP, and it's comprised of wholesale, retail trade, transportation, warehousing, information, finance, insurance, real estate, science, and technology, basically everything else. Because of its size, it doesn't quite fluctuate as greatly as the manufacturers, but there's still quite a bit of quarterly and monthly fluctuations. But again, you see the big one or two quarter drop off there with COVID, only to see it return back to pre-COVID levels. So all of those indicate that the economy was quite strong going into the recession and was able to snap back. That maybe contrasts in comparison with a regular business cycle recession in that it's weak going into it, and it takes quite a bit of time to recover. This was a little different phenomenon. There's much talk. If you turn on the TV right now, all you're going to hear about is inflationary pressures. And while true that inflationary pressures may build, in part because of the stimulus and all the money that has been put into the pipeline here. As of right now, we have not seen that manifest in actual price increases. In fact, we're running still quite tame in terms of historical inflation trends, just under 2% in most cases. But it's something that over the next several months and quarters that we want to continue to track. On page 9 is the Producer Price Index. Now, the PPI measures goods, services, and construction products purchased by other producers as inputs. It measures the first commercial transaction for many products and some services. Now, you would think that what happens at the producer price point early in the supply chain is going to eventually turn up in the consumer price index. Well, that's not always the case. The correlation is not as strong as what one may think, because you never know how businesses will alter their bottom line, their profit margins. If you're able to accommodate higher prices on your inputs without passing it on to the end consumer, you might see increases in your PPI, but that doesn't translate into the CPI. However, that being the case, let's take a look at the last few measures here on this page, and you'll see that the trend is up. So whether or not that lends itself as fuel for eventual CPI increase, that's something, again, we're just going to have to continue to track and see what manifests there. Page 10 is retail sales and some food service sales. This graph, again, is indicative of what we're going to see. Sharp fall off, only to recover very nicely. This very clearly is a V-shaped in terms of this sector. Page 11, the 10-year Treasury rate. We've finally seen a little bit of increase off of what were historic lows back in the summer. Right now we're running at about 1.5 or 1.6%. When the investor has confidence in the growth of the economy, the price of the Treasury bonds decrease and the yield rate increases. So in the past few weeks or month or so, the view is that the economy is on the right direction. Obviously, we have a long way to go, but this rate is often used in many financial transactions, particularly home mortgages, and it's considered an indicator of investor sentiment about the U.S. economy. Page 12 is just Illinois exports. This is, at best, during the best times, a very volatile measure. And, of course, during the current year, the past year, we've shown even more volatility. Of course, the fall off there in April when much of the world's economy and trade was shut down. We have since recovered, at least partially. But even going into the pandemic, it was on a downwards trend. Our greatest trading partners are Canada, Mexico, Australia, Germany, and China. Slide on page 13 shows Illinois manufacturing employment. Again, towards the end of this line, you'll see the typical kind of a Nike swoosh there. I think the takeaway from this chart really is when you go back to the Great Recession back in 08 or 09. I mean, just take a look at that precipitous drop-off there, going back to January of 08. We recovered somewhat in the years after the end of the Great Recession, but just kind of bumped along for a few until we started to catch a little bit more traction in 17, 18. But again, I referenced this earlier. You look at January 19, it actually starts to trend down again. And the thought was that, yes, the manufacturing sector actually is going into a recession. This is even prior to COVID. Now we get into some employment slides over the next several. A lot of it is repetitive. They highlight subtle differences, but we'll just quickly go through them. On page 14, this is the U.S. employment picture, both in the household survey as well as the establishment survey. I mean, things were looking pretty good going into the pandemic period. We were seeing record high employment, record low unemployment, and then, of course, the pandemic hit. Thankfully, we recovered approximately half of the jobs lost, but certainly there is a long way to go. The U.S. lost about 20 to 22 million jobs almost overnight, which was an unprecedented shift in where things were headed. Page 15 shows the same values only on an Illinois-specific basis. You'll see, and this is confirmed in a later slide, that Illinois, we tend to mimic the direction of the U.S. I mean, obviously, we're part of it, and we're a large state. We tend to mimic the direction of the U.S., but oftentimes in downturns, we tend to suffer a little bit more in terms of expansions. We tend to lag. We eventually will sync up, but it takes us longer to do so. So you see that dotted red line kind of shows under the household survey how Illinois fared a little bit worse. Sure.
Explain what the difference is. Let me mention that please add Senator Severson and Senator Sims to the roll. What is the difference in the definition of the household survey and the employment survey, and why would they show different numbers?
The household survey, if you go back to slide 14, it's probably more illustrative there. The household survey is conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau. It's a survey of some 60,000 households. And the respondents are simply asked, are you employed, unemployed, or not in the labor force? That's pretty much it. The establishment survey, the data is a little harder. It's called the payroll survey. So it's conducted by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. So in addition to the number of people on actual payrolls, it also gathers info on hours worked, earnings, the type of sector, and it does not include self-employed. So that is the largest difference between the two measures. In terms of unemployment rates, we'll pick up on page 16. Again, this starts to illustrate what I was talking about. We run in the same direction as the U.S., but tend to fall just a little bit behind. So let's go back to the Great Recession back in the 08, 09, 10 range. As unemployment rates went up, Illinois, being that dotted red line, tend to fare worse by about a percent, percent and a half. And then over the course of the expansion, as the unemployment rates went down in unison, we continued to be about a half a percent to a full percent higher during most of that period. But you'll note, right before the pandemic hit, we synced up again with the nation, running almost the same. In fact, the next page, I think, illustrates it even better. It's a bar chart. But this shows, again, let's go back to 08. Yeah, there was a little bit of differential between the U.S., the Midwest, and Illinois. But really, you know, it's like a half a percent difference, which is really not that great. But then in 09, when the Great Recession really reared its head, our black line, you can see, we're probably 1.5 to 2% higher than the Midwest and the nation as a whole. And then over the course of that 10-year recovery or expansion, that black line started to come together with the other two measures to the point where in 2019, we actually were a tenth better than the nation. So we, once again, very clearly synced up after that 10-year expansion phase. Then, of course, the usual happened in 2020. After a big downturn, we suffered a little bit worse in terms of our unemployment rate, falling behind by about a percent or 1.3%. So I think that pattern has been well established even prior to the Great Recession. There was always the belief that Illinois, just because I think of the compositional makeup of our economy, of our state, whether it be the demographic makeup or other factors, this has now been established for decades, is kind of the way things tend to work its way out. It's not that we don't eventually recover, it just takes us longer. Page 18, there's a lot of information on here. I'll try to boil it down most succinctly as I can. The top half of the page looks at employment by sector in Illinois over time. The highlighted yellow line shows how that has risen or fallen. And the second part of the table, the bottom half, shows those same sectors in an average weekly earnings contest. And again, the yellow line will show how that has changed from the previous year. Now, what we've done at the bottom, that dark blue line, is aggregate both of those highlighted measures to derive a composite annualized wage employment comparison metric. And you can see, let's go to 18. We were running 4.4%, which is a pretty strong measure. You have to go back to 2012. So not only was employment running pretty decently, but wages also were showing some growth. In 2019, again, another good year, 3.4%. But then 2020 hit. Overall, wages continued to support the bottom line. I mean, we were up 5.4%. But if you go up above and look at the actual number of people working, that's where the big fall off was. So in aggregate, you were looking at a minus 1.4% for that metric. So things definitely shifted into reverse in 2020. One of the slides that that Clayton had mentioned, a new slide, is on page 19. What we're trying to do here is show how each of the subsectors have performed, and you're going to see that the recession, that the pandemic, did not treat all subsectors uniformly. In fact, some really bore the brunt of this. And we'll get into this the next slide. But if you go back to April of 2020, you can see after March had a very slight 1% decline, it really hit in April, down 12.9% or $785,000 jobs there lost over the same April of 2019. Things then abruptly recovered. That number fell to 741, then to just under 600,000, then under 500,000, and then started to hover around between 400,000 to 420,000 each of the last several months. So there was market improvement. But when you look at each subsector, you'll see for like leisure and hospitality, for example, how that continues to bear the brunt of the employment decline. From a state revenue standpoint, and we'll get into this in just a second, you know, we're often asked, you know, every monthly briefing you guys put out, it seems like income taxes are holding up pretty well. You know, I thought we were in a pandemic. I thought we were losing jobs. What's going on? Well, one of the things is, yes, we've lost a lot of jobs, but the jobs that we've lost have primarily resided in the lower-paying subsectors. The next page, on the next slide on page 20 illustrates this probably better than any. The green line is the leisure and hospitality subsector, and clearly it's borne the brunt of the pandemic's impact. I mean, the other sectors also have shown declines, obviously. But when you look at who has borne the brunt, I guess it would be the leisure and hospitality. Of course, mining doesn't make up a whole lot. But that clearly, and then the purple here, the other services, trade, transportation, and utilities. So when we look at receipts, we see that in large part they're being supported by the sector who has suffered the worst, but since they also contribute the least in terms of average weekly earnings, the impact on receipts isn't as great as what you otherwise have thought. So those are some of the economic measures that we're seeing. Now let's take a look at look ahead to the forecast period, both this year and next year. One of the commission's services that we look at is called the consensus forecast. It's comprised of about 27 different economic forecasters, some large ones which you'll recognize, IHS Market and Moody's Analytics, which we also have separate contracts with, but then also the professional business associations such as home builders, academic institutions, and even individual businesses such as Ford. They all comprise these different economic forecasts, and then what this report does, the consensus forecast report does, is kind of aggregates all of them. So when you look at all of these different 27 forecasts for fiscal year 21, or not fiscal year, but for calendar year 21, they're looking at real GDP to pop back off of the decline in 2020 by growing 4.7%. followed by a little bit of a moderation in 2022, but still a quite positive 3.6%. The very last line at that table shows what the unemployment rate is expected to do, improving from 8.1 to 5.9%, and then to fall further to 4.7% in the out year of 2022. Page 23 shows the commission's kind of metric firm that we utilize for a multi-scenario analysis, IHS Market, and they give us three distinct economic solutions for the out years. One is the baseline, which has about a 50% chance of occurrence, and the other two, each holding about a 25% probability at this point, is a pessimistic as well as optimistic. You have to really look closely at the lines, because each line is reflective upon itself. So in other words, you can't just look at optimistic versus pessimistic, because everybody's coming off of a different base for the out years. So they look very similar, but there's some subtle differences between the two. But when you boil it down, it's really this. The pessimistic version has us crossing pre-pandemic level further out, more into almost the end of 21 into the beginning of 22. The optimistic, instead, has us crossing pre-pandemic level much earlier, probably in the second quarter, maybe the third quarter. And then the baseline would have us crossing that pre-pandemic level somewhere in between, probably in the second quarter going into the third. So those are the primary differences between the versions. It's more timing than it is actual value of growth. Page 24 simply provides some narrative to each of the associated forecasts. And similarly, page 25 is the correlating measures. I think you get a better feel for the timing aspect of this on page 25. I'll just kind of talk about it quickly. The baseline you can see for 2021 is at 6.1%, and then that declines in 22 to 2.5%. The pessimistic version, you'll note, the value for 22 is actually higher than the baseline, but you have to look at what 21 is anticipated to do, down or growth of only 3.3%. So the pessimistic, we eventually get there, it's just that we're getting there later. So just to give you some context. Page 26 is the Illinois-specific forecast. It's shown very similarly where you have the baseline, 21 growth moderates in 22, whereas under the pessimistic, growth is very similar as the business cycle kind of gets pushed back a little bit. Optimistic version would have things accelerating quickly, much quicker in 21, and then moderating much harder in 22. So it's all about really timing in terms of the differentials between the scenarios. Okay, well now let's finally get into the general fund's estimates here. That's what we're all here today to find out about, right? Okay. Page 28, before we can talk about what the changes are, we need to quickly revisit what the expectations were heading into fiscal year 21. Page 28 shows that the 21 fiscal year budget was based upon a revenue assumption of $42.995 billion, so just under $43 million. Within that plan, it was assumed that the federal stabilization, in whatever form that were to take place, would generate about $5 billion. And also included in that initial assumptions, or in the assumptions for the budget, was about $1.274 billion for passage of the graduated income tax initiative. Well, we know what happened since then. On page 29, there's just a little further breakout of what the budgeted assumptions were way back in May of 20. Again, it kind of racks up the various components. And then towards the bottom, you'll see the $5 billion and the $1.274 billion that was part of the initial budget enacted back in the late spring. Page 30, we thought we would throw a little slide in here about the municipal liquidity facility program that the feds established right after COVID really started back in the first stimulus period. It allowed the states to borrow, well, Illinois specifically, borrow $9.677 billion. However, in the spring, Public Act 101-630 passed, which would have limited our ability to borrow only up to $5 billion. In June, we did tap the program for $1.2 billion. That's expected to be repaid by the end of this fiscal year. And then right before the expiration of the program at the end of December of 2020, Illinois once again borrowed from the program an additional $2 billion, and repayment is expected to occur over the next 3 years. Well, let's get into how revenues have actually performed thus far in fiscal year 21. There's a lot of movement, both in terms of timing as well as other elements. Page 31 shows a bar chart that compares each respective month versus the same year 1 year earlier. You can see in July and August, we had some really big growth. Well, why was that? Well, it's because back in March of last year, or in April, when final payments were delayed, that meant that approximately $1.3 billion of final payments moved from fiscal year 20 into the first few months of 21. So that essentially comprises your big uptick there during the first couple months of the year. Then things kind of stabilized a little bit, but relative to a very, I guess in retrospect, conservative estimate that was put in place during the budget, it actually did overachieve what was initially expected. We'll get into those changes in a second. But then in December, with that $2 billion of borrowing that the state undertook, we were able to turn around that on reimbursable spending, like Medicaid bills, and actually generate an additional, in round terms, an additional $1 billion. And that's where you see that big spike there for December. January and February have returned some very good numbers as well. So when we look at in specifics, we'll see that in terms of base revenues on page 32, base revenues are up $2.719 billion. That's a pretty big number. About $1.3 billion of that, I guess, would be related to the timing aspects of the final payments from 20 into 21. But even stripping those items out, personal income tax, corporate income tax, and I think in particular sales tax, has really impressed and has held up. I remember back in April and May, sales tax was down 20%, 26%. And this was at the same time we were trying to put together a budget for 21. So, of course, we were using some very conservative views. But it wasn't long into the fall we started to see some gains again. In fact, the last 3 months have really bore some pretty good increases in terms of sales taxes. It's quite impressive how the consumer has responded. Now, of course, some of that has to do with the stimulus activity at the federal level, but I think really it adds to the fact that we've been able to, no matter what's been thrown in front of us, the consumer has been able to make its way through this unprecedented period. Okay. Page 33 and pages 34, I'm not going to get into a whole lot. Essentially, it's just a little bit of narrative in terms of how each of the larger revenue sources have performed, why they may have been performing so good. I'll back up for a minute and talk about personal income tax. You know, for a long time, we were a little bit stymied as to why personal income tax continued to hold up so well, given the employment numbers and all the bad news. But when we started to do a little deeper dive into it, we think that one of the reasons is that the enhanced employment benefits, unemployment benefits, really serve to support withholding taxes off of what otherwise would have been much lower levels. If we turn to chart 35, or page 35, I think this is a good illustrative chart. The two bars represent withholding. Now, the time period's a little bit odd. We go back to April of 19 through February of 20 versus this past period of April 20 through February of 21. And you can see that in terms of regular withholding, so this is the withholding from people who are working a job and having their wages withheld, just regular job, regular withholding. We're down 1%. Well, okay, we're down. You know, that kind of, that's logical given the fact that less people are working. Okay, makes sense. But then if you take a look at the other withholding, which is from Form 941, this would include unemployment benefit withholding. Because remember, unemployment benefits are taxable, okay? You can see the dramatic shift. That actually is up 167% above the same period of last year. The scale of the bars really doesn't do it justice, but we're up almost $700 million more from withholding from that component, that that Form 941. So I think that that in part largely explains why we're seeing income taxes being able to be supported off of the off of a lower level than what you otherwise would have thought, given the economy, given the unemployment rate, and so forth. So we think that that's kind of a very appropriate table chart to look at. So moving forward to the actual revenue estimates shown on page 36. We are in March revising our forecast up for this current fiscal year by $2.864 billion on a base level. We do also have to take into account the additional almost $2 billion from December's MLF borrowing. And when you aggregate those two measures, our forecast for 21 actually increases $4.712 billion over our November revision. And I'm going to take just a minute and kind of walk us through that transition period. If you look at this table at the bottom, we'll start in the first column with the enacted May 20 budget. Again, $42.995 billion. At that time, it did include the $5 billion from the Federal Stabilization, or MLF, expected proceeds, as well as the $1.274 from expectations related to passage of the graduated income tax initiative. So moving November, after that initiative failed, of course that had to be removed from the forecast. At that same time in November, however, we did need to reflect the fact that the economic sources, personal, corporate, sales, and some others, really were snapping back much quicker than originally projected. So even in November, we increased our base forecast $2.308 billion. But when you eliminated this additional $6.3 billion of, I guess, non-regular revenues, right, the overall forecast fell $4.1 billion. So that's what got most of the attention in the press, of course, is the big $4 billion budgetary hole. But the underpinnings of that was that the economic sources really were performing quite well. Since November, we've had 4 months of actual data, actual receipt data. Things continue to move in the right direction. So now, in March, we're once again making a large upward revision in the base general funds forecast of $2.864 billion. When you compare the March to the enacted level, we're actually up $5.172 billion over that period. When you look at the non-base general funds revenue towards the bottom of there, you'll see, unfortunately, with the removal of $4.576 billion, the growth of our March forecast over the enacted forecast is a much lower but still respectable $596 million. So we have improved since May by dramatic amounts. And that improvement has occurred despite the substantial reduction in the non-base revenues shown on this chart. Page 37 just provides a higher degree of detail in terms of by revenue source. I really have nothing to necessarily add. It just shows in detail some of the other revenue lines. Again, personal income tax going up a net $999 million. Corporate being revised up $398. Sales tax up $706 million. Oh, I'll mention this. Back in November, the GOMB did make a significant upward revision in federal sources. We delayed our movement at that time simply because of what was happening in Washington. We just didn't really know what to expect coming out of it. But now we feel quite comfortable to going ahead and adopting the revised federal number and revising that up $700 million for fiscal year 21. So as we compare our movement over the year, so we will compare how GOMB has done it as well. We put together this table. It's in the same format as the one we just discussed for COGFA. The movements were very similar, both in terms of direction as well as magnitude. Since the budget enactment, GOMB has increased their base general funds by $5,061 million. That compares to a very similar $5,172 million for COGFA. We have made the same appropriate reductions in the non-base general funds forecast. So both of us have reduced by $4.576 billion from what was assumed during enactment. So at the end of the day, they're assuming revenues to be about $485 million higher than the enacted budget, whereas we are slightly higher, $596 million. The following table will highlight where that $111 million differential resides in terms of the updated forecast for 21. So again, the page 39 kind of lays out in summary here where the differences reside. Personal income tax, very similar, differing by only $29 million, as sales tax is only $16 million difference. And because of the size of those two lines, the estimates are very, very similar. Corporate income tax, the commission is up $149 million above the GOMB. I think in large part it reflects we're able to incorporate all of January, all of February, whereas I'm not sure if they were able to see all of January. Certainly they weren't able to see all of February just because of the timing of when the budget book came out. So we're able to operate with the most updated information. Overall, $111 million difference on a $43.5 billion base obviously isn't a whole lot to write home about. Page 40 just gives a higher level degree breakout of that $111 million. I think I've covered most of that. So fiscal year 22, this is shown on page 41. This is the commission's forecast for fiscal year 22, which is put together under current law. And that's very key when we look at the differences between us and GOMB, is the fact we are utilizing current law as the base to which to make our forecast. So for fiscal year 22, we're looking at base revenues being $40.396 billion. When you compare that with our estimate for base revenues in 21, it's an actual fall off of $1.197 billion. Well, now, wait a minute, Jim. You're just saying how things appear to be on the right track, and now we've got this $1.1 billion fall off. What's going on? Well, remember, this fiscal year, 21, is artificially high relative to those final payments. We have two periods of final payments encapsulated in fiscal year 21. In 22, it's only 1 year. So you're talking about $1.3 billion or so in revenues that 21 is able to benefit from that 22 will not. So the fact that you see negatives there, you really have to put it into the appropriate context. In terms of the underpinnings of the forecast, we're assuming personal income tax will grow approximately 3%. That's a level we're pretty comfortable in. As the economy strengthens, employment levels improve, and personal income patterns normalize, we think that that's an appropriate outlook for fiscal year 22. Corporate income tax, you know, this is one of the most volatile revenue sources that we deal with year after year. It sometimes has no relationship with what's going on with the other economic indicators in the economy. So we're forecasting very little growth there, maybe 1% or so for fiscal year 22. And sales tax, which is, I think, discussed on the following page, we're anticipating, if you look at average sales tax growth historically, you're somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.2 to just under 3%. We're assuming about 2.8%. We're going towards the upper level of the, I guess, normal growth patterns for sales tax, as we think there will be a continued improvement by the consumer, especially as the stimulus works its way through the economy. However, again, I reference our current law requirement. We passed Public Act 10132 a couple of years ago, and that has the consequence of, over a period of 5 years, transitioning sales tax on motor fuel from general funds to the road fund. It's a 5 year period. It's like 20% each year. So we're looking at, in our estimate, about $90 million movement from general funds to the road fund because of that. As you know by now, the governor assumes to not do that. That's one of his initiatives. I think he values about $70 million on that. We're a little bit higher just based on how we think the cost of fuel will go up. We've got a nice table at the back that kind of details all the governor's initiatives. But I just wanted to point that out since we're looking at this from a current law standpoint. I'll follow up by saying also the corporate franchise tax by current law continues to phase out. That is another one of the initiatives of the governor to stop that phase down. But that is part of our forecast for 22. There are a couple other revenue lines, smaller ones. If you look on page 42, maybe you'll see some negatives there and wonder what's going on. We have the benefit of kind of looking back now, and we distinctly can see some revenue lines were impacted by the pandemic, not necessarily in terms of the revenue they produced, but in what fiscal year that revenue ended up being receded. And we think that there was just some natural delays, just because of either administrative purposes or what have you. We eventually got the revenue, but it was just delayed. And we think that there was some movement from 20 into 21. So that's why our forecast for 22 assumes we're kind of going to return to the normal receipt pattern. So you're going to see some fall offs, but it isn't necessarily indicative of an underlying weakness in anything. It's just more timing, maybe getting back to normalize receding. Another large area that's going to have an expected fall off is that of federal sources, down over $400 million for 22. Yeah, obviously this is another hard one to guess at what's going to happen, federal sources. But clearly the state benefited from enhanced match in this fiscal year, as well as direct reimbursements associated with the coronavirus relief fund for prior spending and other funds, and then that came back to the general funds. That's right now, it's not anticipated as part of the 22 outlook. So I hope that I've kind of a little eased your mind a little bit when you see that negative $1.197 billion in base fall off for 22. There's a lot of explanations for that. The bottom line is we do consider underlying growth to be okay, decent, not great, but decent going into 22. But there's a lot of other timing aspects that kind of eat into that underlying growth. Okay, so that's it for CAGFA, but we certainly want to at least give you the comparison between our new forecast for 22 and what the governor just presented in his budget book the middle of February. On page 43, we've tried to do this a couple of different ways. In the blue part of the table there, we simply compare our forecast for 22 with the published GOMB forecast for 22, and it includes all of the various governor initiatives, revenue initiatives. As a consequence, our forecast is a $1.312 billion below that of the governor. So obviously we want to make a more meaningful comparison, more of an apples and apples. So the yellow component of the table attempts to adjust the GOMB estimate to our similar current law levels and based on information provided in the budget book. I will say that the GOMB or the budget book did a great job in explaining the initiatives as well as the values associated with those changes. There's been periods over the last 30 years I've seen where it's a lot less precise. So from my standpoint, when we try to rack up and make it apples to apples, it did kind of make our job a little bit easier. So I do appreciate that. But that aside, the governor does assume about $1.497 billion of revenue initiatives. That's comprised of $932 million of what's considered to be loophole closures or tax expenditure changes, followed up by about $565 million of changes to the current revenue streams. And the following table kind of illustrates what each of those are. But before we get to that, the yellow on page 43 shows when you adjust their forecast by removing those initiatives, they would have a new current law forecast of approximately $40.211 billion, which, when you compare to COGPA's current law forecast, would actually be slightly lower, to the tune of about $185 million. So, yes, you've heard it here. We are slightly higher than they are in terms of our base forecast. I know that you usually we're a little bit lower, but we actually think that things are going to be just slightly higher. Again, you're talking about a base of over $40 billion, a measure of less than $200 million. You know, it's really the estimates are essentially the same. But I just wanted to point that out. Page 44, you know, we've attempted to categorize these various revenue initiatives by the governor a couple of different ways. You probably all see the 932 and then the redirection of existing revenue streams of 565. But, you know, everything that we do ultimately has to transition into what revenue line. And so that's what that table on the right attempts to do, is we break out those same elements, only we put them into the revenue line that we feel would be impacted by those initiatives. Again, they add to the 1.497. They're just a little bit of a presentation difference is all. So that is our conclusion for the forecast. The last several pages are just historical information. But, you know, just wrap things up, the economy is expected to continue to see some moderate gains into the forecast period, continued improvements off of what was historical lows. We saw some historical gains, but now things we think are going to start to settle down, maybe return to normalization during the forecast period. But, you know, let's not kid ourselves. There's an awful lot of uncertainty that still resides out there, and until things are well in hand, it's hard to be too optimistic. Obviously, I think there's a great deal of conservative view probably will bear us out better than assuming things will pop back and be great overnight, because that's just not the way things tend to work out. So. Well, that's what we have for you today. Be happy to answer any questions.
Does anybody have any questions? Senator Severson?
Sure, a couple. First, if we can just quickly go back to page 13. We're talking about the Illinois manufacturing employment numbers. Mm-hmm. How does that track to national? is National Manufacturing's, have we seen more out migration or changes in Illinois manufacturing compared to nationally?
We'd have to probably go back and take a look at that for you. I don't think that the national figure is something that we routinely, you know, keep our database.
Okay.
But we can certainly look at that.
It'd be interesting to see how we're tracking, because we don't know how many of these manufacturing jobs ultimately are either going offshore or if they're just moving to other states, or are we having more manufacturing struggles compared to other states, or is it more other countries? So is it nationwide manufacturing decline or not?
We'll see if we can get some data on that. My gut tells me that you'll probably see similar measures nationally, because when I talk about how the manufacturing sector was likely in recession prior to COVID, that took into account the national manufacturing view, I guess. But that's something that we can probably get data on.
Okay. And then the other one, I guess maybe the easiest way to look at it would be on page 45. So when you're showing the forecast, like, for example, personal income tax dropping from the 24 estimated to the going to the 23 for 22. Is that reduction due to the unemployment extra payments that are being taxable?
No, that's more related to that timing aspect that I talked about, how fiscal year 21 enjoyed those two periods of final payments. So 21
final payments of what? Which, help me again. Final payments of what?
Last April, final payments for income taxes were delayed. You didn't have to pay April 15th. The new deadline was moved to July 15th. And so you had $1 billion migrate from 20 into 21, a double, because within weeks we're going to be seeing a surge in final payments again. So that's why this year is a doubling of the final payments. Next year goes back to one final payment period, and so that in large part gives rise to the expected fall off.
Okay. Then on 35, we talk about the withhold change, which is a lot of that was driven by the enhanced unemployment. In light of the proposed new federal bailout legislation, with what's going to be in there for extended unemployment numbers, do we model that in here as well?
We'll have to, if necessary, make another adjustment in May. I mean, we can only go at to a certain point in time, you know, the time we put these estimates together.
So your snapshot that the enhanced unemployment is ending for this year, or do you model that there would be some enhanced extension for 22?
Well, you can't really get that precise when you're looking too far forward. I think encompassed within our underpinnings of our forecast for 22 is a 3% rate of growth, with a slightly higher than what you otherwise would see of about 2.5%. So almost inherently, we have a little bit.
So you built in, you think there'd
exactly
be something there.
Exactly.
Okay.
But I will mention this, though. As we continue through the fiscal year and into the summer, and if the enhanced unemployment benefits are maintained, right, now we're going to start to see apples and apples comparison. Thus far, it's apples and oranges. We're comparing a time period with the enhanced unemployment benefits to a period without, right? But at some point, should they continue, now you're going to start comparing apples and apples again. So your growth rates reflected here will moderate considerably. Okay, so that's something that would then kind of mute that aspect that you're talking about.
And then in the proposed bailouts, they're talking about on the federal side of not taxing some of those benefits. That would not affect what we're doing here. There's no requirement in that federal bailout that state taxes would not be collected on those same dollars, even though the feds may be not collecting those.
I'm not sure how administratively those two federal versus state benefits would work. As you know, we essentially piggyback off of right, the federal form. When you fill out your Illinois income tax, you pull right from the federal government 1040. To the extent that is adjusted at the federal level, it depends on what we do at the state level. I'm not certain. I just don't know administratively. That's something the Department of Revenue would really have to answer.
Yes, we need to find that out, because that's pretty significant with what they're proposing
to
take out.
$10,000 would not be. But I just don't know off the top of my head how that would be treated. It all depends on what they're taking, you know, where they're taking from the federal form.
Yeah, so if that reduces their actual gross income amount, which is transferred, that's the number you use to do your state taxes.
Right.
That would invertly reduce then the state taxes
but
that would
if,
be paid
but
on
if
that.
We, you know, somewhere it would have to be reported how much total unemployment benefits they receive, right? As long as you're pulling from that, from the you know, a number that includes that, you're okay. It wouldn't affect your state. But if, say, you reduce by $10,000, whatever you're pulling from the Fed, well, that would then ripple over to the state.
Right.
If my rudimentary understanding of what they're proposing would be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that would have to be looked at, and a call would have to be made by the department as to what to do there.
Okay, great.
But
thank you.
So it's a good observation.
Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions? I have a couple quick questions. So when you talked about the delay in income tax filing being pushed into fiscal year 21, can you get a side-by-side of actual fiscal year 20, fiscal year 21, and then a proposed fiscal year 20 so we can see what those actual numbers are? Because when we, you know, my concern is when we budgeted for fiscal year 20, we were including that revenue in fiscal year 20, but it was pushed off into fiscal year 21, so technically it was counted in 20 and 21, correct?
Well, the revenue didn't transpire in 20 as you originally thought, so to the extent that developed a old bill, you know, that when revenues don't come in, right, and your spending doesn't change, what happens is your bills on hand grows.
Yes.
So it isn't, the value is about $1.3 billion. That's the amount that was moving between 20 and 21.
Okay.
About a billion is personal, and about $300 million of that is corporate. So to the extent, if you're looking at a strictly June 30th cutoff period, the effect of not having that revenue probably impacted on your old bills at that point in time. But then as that flops over to July and August, then all of a sudden you got this additional $1.3 billion of revenue that you normally don't get in July and August, right? So it's more of a timing aspect as to what side.
So was that $1.3 billion accounted for in the revenue estimate for fiscal year 21 that
yes.
was actually passed?
Yes, because we passed it in end of May, so we knew that those final payments were going to transition from 20 into 21. So that had no bearing on.
So, but those revenues were used to put together the spending for fiscal year 21 in 21. So what was the effect on fiscal year 20 by not having, I mean, obviously it's, you know, minus $1.3 billion
right.
dollars of revenue, correct?
Right. Right.
So we were, and, you know, that's, I think we budget year to year. So, we look at the revenues that are coming in this year, which are, you know, obviously within this, you know, from this date to this date, and we forgot about fiscal year 20 already that was $1.3 billion behind. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Still spent that money in fiscal year 20, probably, or fairly close.
Well, if you didn't have the money, you can't spend it. What happens is
the bills push forward.
Old bills goes up is what happens.
You put it on the credit card, right?
Put it on the credit card.
Yeah.
That's right.
Which you'll eventually have to pay next year. Were those debts included in fiscal year 21?
Well,
that's my concern.
Remember what we did in June of 20. We tapped that MLF.
Okay. Yeah.
Of 1.2. billion.
The borrowing, yep.
Right.
Yep.
And I'm sure that that went a long way towards alleviating the budgetary pressure that built up by not having that final payment period.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the replacement resource for that timing element.
Which we will have paid off by the end of this fiscal year,
that
correct?
That is correct.
But the $2 billion will be paid off over the next 3 years.
3 years, that is correct.
Okay, yes. So we will, I mean, we're still pushing debt into the future years, correct?
Sure,
okay.
Yeah, we're going to have to pay that off.
The PUA, I've had a lot of constituents coming in, hairdressers and mechanics and whoever who own their own shops who were given unemployment insurance. I have a lot of them coming back in saying, you know, the state figured what I owe. They gave me all this money, and now they're saying I owe them $7,000 back or $10,000 back. Are those dollars included in this if the state says that individuals owe that back to the state of Illinois? Or does that not count as revenue?
I'm not really...
Okay, I may have to talk to you about it afterwards,
yeah.
So we can get our heads together to see how that is. Are there any concerns on sales taxes? During the pandemic, the renter's moratorium, I believe that, especially in my district, I know a lot of renters have decided not to pay their rent and instead have spent that money in the... Walmart buying a new TV or whatever, and obviously federal influx of money has affected that as well. Do we have concerns that when renters' moratorium goes away that there will be a similar effect on sales tax, or is that such a small percentage of the overall?
Yeah, I don't know if you could necessarily quantify what the effects of that behavioral pattern would be.
Yeah.
The one measure that gives us cause to think we'll be able to support pretty decent sales tax numbers going forward is we've seen measures in terms of the savings
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people have been able to build up over this period. So we have some fuel, right, that when the economy does start to slow, there may be some fuel available from the consumer to keep things going, at least at a modest rate of growth.
Okay.
So that's why, you know, our underpinning for sales tax is 2.8%. I mean, that's okay. It's not fantastic or anything. We think that's a level that seems to make sense given the fact that we will be in a continued expansion period, we hope,
mm-hmm.
And that there is some savings associated with what's happened in terms of the stimulus and that. So we do have a little bit of ammunition set aside.
Okay. Anybody else have any other questions?
Yeah, one follow up.
Okay.
Just follow up a little bit along those same lines. With we know with restaurant and restaurants and bars, those sales taxes were obviously all down, but we had a big increase in people doing their home repairs. So the Walmarts, the Lowe's and the Home Depots and the Menards have had record years. We've also started to see signs of more increased home construction than we've seen before. Knowing that from a macro sense, construction dollars get churned more often than sales tax, where you get spent one time and then the dollar leaves the state. With construction remodeling, that dollar is churned a few more times. Do we model that, or do we have a way to measure how much of this growth is coming from those types of sales, and is that what kind of economic impact that's going to have?
That, to us, all kind of gets baked into the pie. When you start to trying to forecast specific elements of a source as large as sales taxes, you can run into some real problems of not having the sum of those estimates making sense when you aggregate them. So I understand what you're getting at, but in terms of do we model specifically for that, no, not necessarily. But what happens when you remodel? What happens when you build? Well, the next thing you do is you got to buy new appliances, right? So, again, all of those activities would help support sales tax going forward.
Yeah, I guess that's just the macro side of it, because right. when you hire someone to do that remodeling, now that guy you hired, he's got to go out and buy new tools and supplies, and that
sure.
that so that dollar gets churned so many more
right.
times,
right.
which
Understood.
Is why building things is so much better than buying things. But on the 13% increase in income tax that we were looking at before, does that is that number... that's including that $1 billion of personal income tax that's
if
carried over from 20?
If you're looking at the year-to-date table that I think we had, let me quickly turn to it, on page 32.
Yes.
Yes, we had, on a net basis, it's 1.809 on a gross basis, 13.1%. I'll adjust that to a net basis. It's about 1.6 billion. Of that 1.6, I would say about a billion of that is related to the timing. So you're still looking at some pretty decent overall income tax growth numbers through only two-thirds of the fiscal year. I mean, any other fiscal year, I think you'd take that, right?
Right. But we would subtract that. We can't say that we had 13%. Increased growth, because that includes on the personal side a little over a billion, on the corporate side was what 300 or something.
I mean, the actual number is 13%, but you need to know the backstory and say of that amount, it's fueled by $1 billion of timing,
right?
But that would mean you would still have, you know, you'd still have 500 or 600 million of true growth,
right? But a layman looking at this, we're not going to look at it and say we had 13% increase in income tax year over year. We didn't, because
that would be,
timing
that's correct.
Of that. So
that's
okay, correct. I just want to make sure that was included in that. So, all right, thank you.
Clayton, anything to follow up?
No, I would just. I'll just mention again the timing for our next meeting. We're looking at second or third week of April for our group insurance meeting.
Okay. All righty. I think unless anybody else has any more questions, I appreciate Jim and Clayton, everybody from COGFA. Thank you for all you do, and look forward to seeing you in April. Thank you. We are adjourned.